This podcast is brought to you by Aviation Safety Magazine, the monthly journal of risk management and accident prevention.
Hello, I'm Glenn Pugh for AvWeb.com. Ed Lovick was the first radar signature reduction expert brought in by Kelly Johnson to try to make the U-2 less visible to radar. He worked at Lockheed Skunk Works through its most active decades. His projects included the A-12, the SR-71, the D-21 unmanned aircraft, and the F-117 Nighthawk. When a Freedom of Information Act request in 2007 disclosed previously classified information about the Oxcart, the A-12, a predecessor of the famed SR-71 Blackbird, it showed that Kelly Johnson credited Ed Lovick with saving the program. It's a factual statement that his slide rule, if he can part with it, may end up in the Smithsonian. It's my great pleasure to be speaking with him today. Mr. Lovick, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me, and please call me Ed.
Well, thank you very much, Ed. I want to give our listeners an understanding of where you come from. How old were you, and where were you, and what was the first airplane you ever saw?
I think I was 12 years old or so, and I know for sure that I was a World War One trainer called a JM-4D or a Jenny, and I actually touched the lower right-hand wing of the airplane. It was a big thrill.
About what year was that?
That had to be about 1935, 36.
Now, I don't want to skip through this the way I will, so let me mention to our listeners that Ed's written a book about his life in aviation. It's called Radar Man, and there are far more details there than we'll be able to cover here, but we're going to skip ahead. We're going to pass through your training in electrical engineering, your job at Lockheed, your time teaching radio and radar tech in the service during World War II, through your years at Douglas, to bring us to your time at Lockheed, where you worked for Kelly Johnson. What were your first impressions of him?
Well, first of all, it was a total surprise because two of my people I knew very well came to a place where I was doing some work, and I had no idea who Kelly Johnson was, despite the fact that I had worked at Lockheed for several years, and Kelly Johnson had been world famous for I don't know how many years as a great aircraft designer. Well, I met him in August of 1957. I remember that very well.
And Johnson, as you'd mentioned to me earlier, was a keen aerodynamicist, and you were his stealth guy. I'd imagine that between radar signatures and aerodynamics, well, sometimes those things don't work in perfect harmony. What was the work environment like under Kelly?
Well, my experiences with Kelly seemed to be unusual because I had nothing but, everything seemed to be smooth. I was able to talk to him man-to-man. I suppose that's because I hadn't really realize how famous the man was. But during the conversation, he asked me several technical questions. I don't remember what they were, but apparently the answers were satisfactory. And he asked me if I'd be interested in working on a project that might take about 6 months. 32 years later, I retired from the Skunk Works.
What did you think of Kelly Johnson as a boss and as a peer and personally?
He was an extremely fast learner, I found out the hard way one day. I think I had unusually good relationships with him because I don't remember any unpleasant problems at all. Some people seem to have a fear of him, but I never did. I did have one time when I was a little startled, but I referred to a perfectly, to me, perfectly legitimate term of Johnson noise, which is prominent in some kinds of electrical and electronic equipment, and he had never heard of it, of course, so I had to show it to him in a book to make sure he really understood it, but he seemed to be more than satisfied about knowing it. But as I say, he was a very fast learner, and he learned quite a lot about electromagnetic theory.
It seems to me that this is all engineering. It seems like numbers crunching, but when you and I spoke earlier, you relayed some what I thought were sort of personal anecdotes that seemed more lighthearted than I would have expected. Would you tell me about the memo that you received about keeping weights down on the, was it the A-12?
Yes, it was. That memo was a directive or a plea to all the engineering people who were involved in designing the airplane to do all they could to reduce the weight of the aircraft, because that's what determined how high the aircraft could go. And that was one of the critical parameters that we were trying to optimize for the A-12 airplane. But he suggested that every engineer come up with an idea to save at least 1 pound. And if they couldn't, they could get together with their friends and they could pool their weight savings for their own credit. And down at the bottom of the memo, there was a little note that, but those who didn't do it, didn't save any weight, that there was a form for retirement in his office.
And that was serious or that was a joke? How did you take it?
Well, it was semi-serious. He always was, of course, very much interested in keeping the weight down because that was a critical parameter. But it was I interpreted it at least as a joke.
I mentioned earlier that Johnson appears to have tipped his cap to you with regard to the Oxguard, the predecessor of the very famous SR-71 Blackbird. Why do you think he might credit you for having saved that program?
Well, we had a progress meeting with the people we called the customers, the CIA people, with some of their consultants to report our progress in the design of the A-12 aircraft. And everything went quite well until we got to the point where Dr. Bissell, who was in charge of the whole program, was very concerned about the size of the exhaust opening in the aircraft. There were two exhaust openings, each were 5 feet in diameter, which allowed a huge amount of radar energy to enter and then be reflected out. And it covered very, very large angles of incidence, so that it was actually a major problem. And he was on the verge of canceling the program, and so I just suggested that the way we could take care of that would be to ionize the gases coming out of the exhaust and turn them into something that was partially electrically conductive, and that would either scatter the energy away or absorb it and turn it into heat. And two of his physicists who were with him and were very enthusiastic about the idea, so that what Kelly said saved the program at that time. I had a lot of fun later on demonstrating how well it worked and so forth.
You must have seen, I'd imagine, some amazing things over your career, some of them very inspiring like that moment and some, I'm afraid, very tragic. Would you tell us the story about Lou Chalk?
Well, Lou was the pilot who flew the first flight of the A-12 aircraft. This was done at Area 51. I wasn't there at the time, but I heard about it, of course. But what happened was that Lou started to take the airplane up on a demonstration flight, as well as a test flight. And as soon as the airplane lifted off the ground, it became unstable. Kelly Johnson said it was the worst, most horrible-looking takeoff he ever saw, because when the airplane just got clear of the ground, apparently Lou wanted to make some kind of a control change. He pushed the stick forward, the airplane turned left. When he pulled the stick back, of course, the airplane turned right, and it wobbled around just a very short distance above the ground for a long time, and it could have crashed right away, and it perhaps would have, but Lou was able to think so quickly that he was able to bring the airplane under some semblance of control and return it back down to the airstrip.
What was the particular challenge that Lou was working with that time?
Well, what was discovered later, of course, was that the gyros that control the pitch and the gyros that control the yaw were miswired so that they were doing different functions. So pitch control made the airplane yaw, and yaw control made the airplane pitch. Lou was able to figure all that out in what seemed like a few seconds and get the airplane back on the ground.
Now, you played a major role in the 117 Nighthawk program. What were the biggest challenges you faced there, and what do you think of the final product?
Well, first of all, of course, it was not a fighter because it was actually designed to be a air-to-ground attack aircraft. It did not have any kind of defensive or offensive weapons on it. It was strictly for reconnaissance and, of course, the air-to-ground role. And I think it did very well.
How is it that in that situation it ended up with the F designation?
I believe it was an attempt by someone, the Air Force, to deceive the bad guys, who in those days were the Soviet Union. As I say, it had no fighting capabilities other than just launching a missile to the toward a ground target, which it did very well in Iraq.
How did you feel when you learned that one had been shot down during the NATO campaign over Serbia in 1999?
Well, first of all, I didn't know about it immediately. I don't know how long later, but my first reaction was, I wonder if the pilot was killed or if he'd been captured. I wasn't aware that at that time, right away, that there was an attempt to recover the pilot, which they did. I think that what caused the problem was the aircraft was very, very difficult to detect it by radar from any direction. And I think what happened was that the flight plan people allowed them to fly the same route several times, and that kind of made it easier to find. They actually probably could hear the airplane fly over, so they shouldn't have done that.
Well, you mentioned that unlike the SR-71, this one was something that you could track by sound. What were the figures you mentioned about the SR-71 as far as the boom reaching the ground?
Oh, well, it flew so high and so fast that the sonic boom would reach the ground after the aircraft was more than 10 miles away from where the sonic boom hit the ground.
So it was already 10 miles gone.
Yeah. I've told some people who had a reasonable need to know, like you, that if they were to fly that aircraft from, say, Van Nuys Airport to San Diego, they could get there in 3 minutes, but they'd have to go so far into the Mexican airspace to turn around, they'd probably be at least 50 miles over the border.
Now, these aircraft had some outstanding performance numbers. Are there any that you can share? What were the, in the end, the SR-71, what altitudes and speeds was it capable of reaching?
It has been published that the aircraft would fly at 2,000 miles an hour ground speed, 80,000 feet. Every pilot every crewman who was in an aircraft that did that was presumably also designated as an astronaut, because 60,000 feet was supposed to be the lowest altitude at which a person could be designated as an astronaut. So we had a bunch of astronauts flying around and didn't even know it.
Looking back, I want to ask you if you can pick one moment that stands out to you from your time working on what I believe are arguably the most advanced, most secret, and perhaps most capable aircraft designs this country and maybe the world has ever known. Do you have a favorite memory?
Well, I don't know. I have a lot of nice memories, such as watching a U-2 take off, and I was looking up the tailpipe until it disappeared into the mist. It would go up at, well, pretty spectacularly.
In the proposal process for the aircraft that would eventually become the F-117 Nighthawk, you had sort of a watershed moment there in the proposal. Could you tell me about that?
Ed needed something to really stir up their interest. So I suggested to him that the airplane, when it viewed from the front as it was approaching its target, would look to the radar that was involved as though it was only a 9/16 diameter steel ball. Ed understood that, and he liked it, so he had me get a collection of them so he could take them back to the conference that was going to happen in Washington, D.C., instead of in Burbank. And when he came home, and he told me that, well, the steel balls were a great success, and he said there were steel balls rolling all over the conference table. So it was a success, and it also was true. You know, it really was that hard to detect.
How did that compare to the normal radar signature of an aircraft of that era?
Well, I'll say like an aluminum sheet is about 10 feet square, 10 feet by 10 feet. It was pretty, 10,000 to 1 ratio was a pretty good change.
10,000 to 1, so you've got a 10 foot by 10 foot metal square versus a 9/16 inch ball bearing?
Yeah, it was a major change in radar, anti-radar technology at that time. And I don't think anybody's done any better. It's always possible, you know. But in this case, I've never heard of anything coming even close to that.
Ed Lovick, the first radar signature reduction expert brought to Kelly Johnson's Skunk Works. You can find more at edtheradarman.com. His book, Radar Man, A Personal History of Stealth, is available there and at all major book outlets. This has been Glenn Pugh for avweb.com. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is brought to you by Aviation Safety Magazine, the monthly journal of risk management and accident prevention.